Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 29th of September 2018. This is probably episode 5, getting up to page 44. I'm sorry it's taken so long to read. Science for the People by Simon Ings. Addiction is a captivating subject to launch a new gallery that takes down the boundaries around science, finds Simon Ings. So it's a review of a gallery exposition in London. But now obviously us Aussies love to read about this type of stuff. And I think what I might do is I might ease up and increase the quality, the audio quality, increase the size of my MP3s. In the spacious atrium of the New London Science Gallery, Lauren Epps is tweaking the workings of a repurposed coin-pushing arcade game. In part of the gallery's first show, Hooked, he hands me one of 10,000 handmade terracotta tokens. I'll be lucky enough to win a gold leaf token, or maybe one of the ceramic ones stamped with images of an exotic sunset? No. Reluctantly, I'm hooked already. I leave again, which is in italics, and follow Hannah Redler's whores up the stairs. Hooked is Redler's whores responsibility. Fresh from co-curating at the Opera Delta Institute with data artist Leela Johnson, she took on the task of building London's Science Gallery launch exhibition. She soon found herself in a room with six, quote, young leaders selected from local schools and London boroughs of Southwark and Lambeth who, for the past year, have been shaping the direction of London's newest public institution. Quote, "We're not a neutral space," she explains. "We're interested in all things that make simple facts hard to find. In a show about addiction, that means thinking seriously about all the personal and social factors that might drive people to harm. And by people, Redler Hall means all of us. Addiction," she argues, "is a normal part of life. Every tribe has its social lubricants. As she points out, we are creatures who like to explore, who like pleasure, who like extending our boundaries intellectually, emotionally and physically. And we are also creatures who aren't that fond of pain. So when we encounter it, we look for an escape route. A visit to Hooked's becomes increasingly unnerving. As one by one you identify all the apparently innocuous corners of your life that contain at least elements of addictiveness, from caffeine to Facebook. That journey begins with the show's iconic image, a lolly turned pincushion from a series called Another Day on Earth by Olivia Locker, whose work explores the moment when getting what you want becomes taking what you can't help but take. The Science Gallery ethos is to leave the visitor with more questions than answers. It's here to pick curiosity rather than address ignorance. The success of this approach, pioneered by Science Gallery Dublin in 2008, can be measured by the project's rapid expansion. There are Science Galleries planned for Bangalore this year, Venice in 2019, Melbourne in 2020, not to mention pop-ups everywhere from Detroit to Davos. Science Galleries do not amass private collections. Each show is curated by someone new, displaying works from art, science, engineering, and territories that frankly defy classification. Shows already announced for London include Expedition of Dark Matter and Prosthetics. That latter show, explains the gallery departing director Daniel Glasser, is going to be very hands-on. A different proposition to Hooked, then, which is about the international art. Sorry, got to get this out. Art and curatorial rigor. Glasser joins our exploration of the wet paint and bubble wrap of a half-assembled exhibition. Among the more venerable pieces are the Richard Birmingham's film from the late 1990s, capturing gestures and habits of life on benefits in deprived corner of West Bromwich, UK, where he grew up, smoking, snorting, hammering away at the PlayStation might be addictive behaviours or might become addictive, but the film reminds us that they're ways of dealing with boredom. They kill time. They are ordinary activities of obvious and of obvious utility. I don't think that's utility. Quote, we are all users, which means we're all at risk of tipping into harm. This is Rilla Hawes. Addiction is a natural part of being human. It's a problem when it's harming you, but when that happens, it's not just it's not just you that's the problem. The point was brought sharply to focus for her when she discussed addiction with the gallery's young leaders group. This is a nice good, yeah. My idea of addiction was a 40-something in a room unable to work, but these young people were absolutely engaged and a bit afraid that so much of the environment they had grown up on was very obviously vying for their attention. And quite literally trying to get them hooked. Naturally enough, then, online experiences features heavily in the exhibition. Artist Rachel McLean celebrated the extreme uncanny film Feed Me, 2015. It's a twisted fairy tale where the ghastly characters communicate in emojis and text speak as each pursues a lonely path in search of the unattainable. Wow, that sounds great, doesn't it? More immediately and more poignant from my point of view is a new video installation by Joel Quintero, Me, You, Limbo, which is very quickly convinces you that your phone is much more part of you than you've ever realized. Everyone who has ever had a relationship decay into a series of increasingly bland what is app messages will get it. A lot of these pieces are about love. Riddler Hall comments quietly. Although the emphasis here is on established artists, there are pieces that point to just how mischievous the hands-on this institution is likely to become in the years ahead. Katrina Beale's Entering a Machine Zone 2 is a new commission developed with the assistance of Henrietta Bowden-Jones, founder of the first NHS Gambling Connect. It is the world's most pointless video game, though I defy you to stop playing it once you've started. It propels you with frightening rapidity towards the dissociative state that, for gamblers in particular, is a real attraction of their vice, far more addictive than the promise of money. That's interesting. It's also the state one achieves when climbing a demanding learning curve. Addiction in a guise of flow isn't bad, though then, of course, we call it a passion. Not everyone will be comfortable with this show's broad definition of addiction, but there's nothing lazy about it. If the show doesn't change your mind, it will certainly have sharpened your opinions. The tour drone Gaza takes me around the building itself, a £30 million development that has transformed a car park and an unused wing of the original 18th century Guy's Hospital into a major piece that papers like to call the public realm. What this boils down to is people come and eat their lunches there and find themselves talking to lively, well-briefed young people about curious objects that turned out about the topics that don't often come up in ordinary conversation. Accessibility here is about more than wheelchairs. It's about ensuring that people who used to visit the McDonald's that formerly occupied the cafe area can still find affordable food there. This is important. There is a hospital next door and streets full of people desperate for steady cup of tea. It's about building a terrace around the gallery's 150-seat theatre so you can come in and see what's going on without finding yourself intruding or getting trapped in something you're not interested in. It's about getting into conversations with the staff rather than being approached only when you are doing something wrong. Gasser, who has spent the past 5 years directing this project, is a neurologist by trade and is clearly aware of the difference this space will make to the researchers at King's College London, the university associated with Guy's. These days, knowing how to communicate with the public is a key component of to securing funding. With the Science Gallery, Gasser tells me, a major world university is turning to face the public. It's becoming an asset to London. We're part of the city at last. Well, I'm glad they think so. Okay. Now, that was culture, so that was a thing. And this is another piece, and this is a book review. And it's a book, The Book of Humans. What's the latest on how we differ from animals? Michael Bond catches up. A Book of Humans, The Story of How We Became Us. As any cat lover will tell you, humans do not have all the tricks. We think ourselves special, but many species are just as proficient and adapted to their environment and manipulating circumstances to their own needs. We behave like gods, yet we are irrefutably animals. What then, if anything, sets us apart? In The Book of Humans, science writer Adam Rutherford tries to answer by embarking on a kind of intellectual enema. Oh, here you go. Exposing popular myths about human exceptionalism and setting on a few core truths. Except that there is something unique about Homo sapiens and our evolutionary journey, but delights in reminding us, as Charles Darwin did, of the undeniable stamp of our lowly origin. Like the soul, the attributes that define the humanist are surprisingly elusive. Well, good God, I wouldn't say that. Okay, soul, that's a bit weird to put in there. It is often said that we are shaped by our technology, and yet we are not the only tool users. Some sea urchins, insects, spiders, crabs, snails, octopuses. Snails, I never heard of a snail using a tool. Good God. Octopuses, fish, birds, and other mammals manipulate objects to help them access food or exploit their habitats. Tools, would you think that would be your hermit crab? I don't know. We are the only animals that cooks, but not alone in our use of fire. Aboriginal Australians have recorded hawks deliberately setting bushfires to chase out small animals. We also excel in violence, although so do chimpanzees, whose societies appear as warlike as our own. Nor does our appetite for non-reproductive sex stand out. Other animals masturbate, elephants and dolphins, and oral sex bears. I sort of almost believe that I've read this before. These behaviours may cement social bonds. They also seem to be for pleasure. So, though most biologists are unable to read animals' minds, are reluctant to acknowledge this. What's left? One thing is unique to us, although perhaps the Neanderthals had it, also had it, is language. Rather than leave it at that, Rutherford focuses on what enables us to communicate, share information about resources, and exchange ideas. My problem is with my memory. I do remember reading this information over and over again. Culture is the key. In other words, without it, we would be just another animal. The Book of Humans is the vein of Noah Harari's Sapiens, but Rutherford's tone is less exalted, his approach more questioning. As a geneticist, he is appreciative of the messy and convoluted way in which modern humanism has emerged. Okay, just getting it. We're just on the, you know how the pages, fold over the edge? In which modern humanist has emerged, quote, there's no single genetic change that made us Homo sapiens. There isn't a gene for speech, creativity, imagination, spear throwing, dexterity, consciousness, or even cultural transmission. There wasn't a moment when we were not human before. He makes a charming guide, giving the impression that, like us, he finds it all rather mysterious, though he clearly knows what he's talking about, quote, I've dissected a lot of pigs' brains in my times, quote, he writes before launching into an examination of animal cognition. The small details interest him as much as the big picture. Explanation of how genetic makeup differs from that of other primates is carefully considered, as is discussion of why small populations with less cultural sophistications are less likely to survive than large ones. Knowledge brings understanding, but it also makes things messier. The recent discovery that the earliest figurative art was created not by us but by the Neanderthals has confounded our assumptions about our cousins. There you go. I like that. Neanderthals make art. And I think it's even earlier. I think the lines on shells go way back, millions of years. They had a culture, but they didn't survive. Are other species contemporary humans yet found? Did we breed with them? Rutherford thinks the answer is both certainly yes. Quote, the picture of how we came to be is going to get more and more complicated as we continue to discover, he says. We should revel in this complexity and celebrate the fact that we alone are capable of understanding it. Now that is a beautiful ending. Isn't a beautiful ending? Oh, I think we're going to finish quite soon. Coming up to letters, I'm sure I love reading the letters. At least it's a reflective comment and it's outside these people who've got a ticker box. I've got AI, CRISPR, and and things like that. Okay. Editor's pick of the letters. I love that. There's lots of editors. Here's the editor's pick. From Peter Inkpen, Asham, Buckinghamshire, UK. And there's a bear. Oh, it's all right. That bears. When they give a license to shoot bears, bears hear a gun and they sort of automatically go, oh, there's free lunch. If you shoot something in one of the parks, they come up and say, let's eat some of the entrails. And they come up and they shoot a gun and they walk towards you. Mark Burkoff decries the planned grizzly bear hunt near Grand Teton Yellowstone National Parks in the US. He mentions that 21 hunters were licensed by lottery and the wildlife photographer Thomas Mackinson wrote one of the permits to hunt grizzly bears and does not plan to use that prize. Magson thus reduced the number of shooters that participate by one. Should the courts finally approve the hunt? It occurs to me that tens of thousands of people who care passionately about the bears were also to enter any future lotteries for a permit. The odds that some would win and deprive the number of hunters the means of legally kill these magnificent animals. Some 7,000 people applied for the most recent permits. Assuming the number of permits available each year is fixed, if 14,000 additional people entered the lottery, the chances are that only 7 permits would end up in the hands of hunters. Of course, a far better solution would not be issued any permits at all. That's really good, isn't that lovely? Populism won't wilt without redistribution. Simon Oxham describes a data analysis suggesting that waves of support for populist politics peaks 10 years after financial crises and asks if it will be the same this time as economies recover from 2008 crash. But the recent populist surge may not follow this pattern if the decade after the start of the final crisis is a crisis. Too many people fear the situation hasn't improved. Many people see reports of rising GDP or falling unemployment, but feel the system isn't working for them personally. A few at the top have captured most of the growth of GDP, for many, personal wealth has not grown. A large part of many people's income goes to accommodation, made more costly by property price boom that is fostered by low interest rates after the crash. This leaves people feeling poorer. Telling such people that the economy is recovering may lead to resentment and a feeling that they are missing out. This is likely to stoke more populism when they ask, quote, who is getting the rewards of growth? I'm not. Economic redistribution as well as economic recovery is essential. I don't know whether she really got, Hillary Short got that, that's Hillary, okay. We are not cleverer than directionless evolution. Mark Dawson, Leeburg, Virginia, USA. You ask, what kind of force is evolution? Evolution isn't a force. It's a description of a process which species change over time in response to their environments. And it makes no sense to see it as either malevolent or beneficial, although you may like or dislike the results of the process it describes. Using the term force can reinforce the fallacy called teleology, that evolution changes as directed to some objective beyond the species simply changing to fit its environment. Now, I've got to really get all those terms in my head. Teleology is interesting. There's a system of logic and all that type of stuff. I keep on reading it, but can't remember it. On the same topic, from Andrew Scott, Perth, UK. You announced your report on the ways for evolution by saying on your cover, nature used to decide how life turned out, now we do. But we are the products of nature's evolution, and everything we do is part of the evolutionary process. If our attempts to be smart eventually cause our extinction, that will be just one of the more many previous dead ends of evolution. We are part of nature. We are not smarter than everything we do, including modifying genes, is just part of the much evolution as a fish popping onto some ancient shore. I don't know. I sort of remember this is about, we can genetically engineer our way out of evolutionary junk. Awful. Michael Lepage quotes Stephen Palumbi describing the triple drug therapy for HIV as one of the first truly evolutionary treatment strategies. Much the same strategy was used 60 years ago in the early days of antibiotic treatment of tuberculosis. Streptomycin, the first anti-TB antibiotics, became available in UK in 1948. When the country's Medical Research Council tried using it to treat pulmonary TB, it failed because after 140 days, 85% of the cases had developed drug resistance. In 1954, John Crofton, when a professor of respiratory medicine in Edinburgh, used a combination of three drugs for 3 months, followed by 15 months on two of them. It worked, and this has been the basic principle of tuberculosis treatment ever since. But pulling the conclusion that we will never completely solve the problem is correct. TB continues to develop antibiotic resistance, pushed by poor prescribing, poor compliance by some patients, and supply of quality problems with the antibiotics. Green vehicles can still cause air pollution. You list the emissions of electric cars as none. I'm in full enthusiastic support of research and development of non-fossil fuel burning vehicles, but must point out that a lot of battery electrical vehicles have no emissions at the point of use, and unless they are all charged from renewable power sources, their source of electricity is likely to result in fossil fuel burning. The editor writes, we use emissions in the sense of what comes out of the car. As you say, carbon impact of charging is an important too, as that of building it. Just to add a bit more. Electric meters that are unsmart are a headache. Colin Cook, this is from Steve Swift, Meadstead, Hampshire, UK. Colin Cook observes that smart meters make for noisier neighbours, with people running washing machines at night when the electricity prices drop, for example. In a similar vein, I use off-peak. Can you wait for me as I turn the page? Sorry about this. Off-peak electricity recharge my electric car on Economy 7 tariff, which offers cheaper power for 7 hours each night. The old meter that goes with this is even more stupid than most. The clock is synchronized with the main suppliers. In our rural area, this is erratic and the clock loses time. A cheap rate of electricity comes on a little later after every power cut. Well, thanks for telling us that. I'm much more amazed because that's really changed the argument. Neanderthals, Devonians and Sapiens are all people. So these are all different types of things. I think Neanderthals are pretty, well, it's interesting. I'm always amused to read. This is by Elizabeth Bell, Great Shepherd, Berkshire, UK. These villages of great something or other. You go into them and are they great? I don't know. I'm always amused to read articles on human ancestry and the findings relating to how Homo sapiens interbred with other species such as Neanderthals and Denisovans. You report, for example, that prehistoric teenager was the offspring of two species interbreeding. Long ago, came to the conclusion from reading reports such as this that Homo sapiens, Neanderthals and Denisovans are variants on the same hominid species, and this and that our current relatively narrow Homo sapien gene pools represents lost genetic diversity. It seems likely that when the groups met, they probably just saw each other as people with different appearances and cultures, not separate species. Thank you. I don't know if they're thinking all that much. The tale of James Croll and the Ice Ages is untangled. So he's the person who figured out there was ice ages, James Croll. How he did it, I can't remember. I do remember him, Scottish one. I do remember that he was a janitor, something like that. And then disappeared. Okay. From David Studgeon, Lonehead, Midlothian, UK. Wherever this is, UK sounds such a complex place. It was good to see James Croll recognised as the first scientist to link ice ages with orbital fluctuations. Oh, that's the orbital Earths. Ages. The loss of support for his ideas in the late 19th century may, however, have less to do with Victorian's stiffness about his working class background than with his work apparently being contradicted by subsequent dating of ice ages. He assumed that the key driver of ice ages was the amount of sunlight reaching the northern hemisphere in winter, and wrote that we may safely conclude that considerably more than 100,000 years since the glacial epoch. It later emerged that much of the past 100,000 years was taken up with the last ice age. We do not know that summer, we now know that summer, not winter temperatures, are key for glacial survival. Had Cole calculated on this basis, he would have been spot on. Isn't that beautiful? So he was basically wrong. That's a really interesting thing. So the Earth's orbit goes from circular to round, and it's precession. So at the moment, Australia has a shorter summer, closer to the sun. Fred Pearce said Kroll's ideas were only revived by Milenkov in the 1930s. Now, this is Milenkov period. However, Robert Ball, Royal Astronomer of Ireland, a noted popularizer of astronomy, gave talks on ice ages in 1886, acknowledged Kroll's work. In 1890, he published The Cause of the Ice Age. His copy was originally presented as an English prize in a girls' school, so the book must have been in wide circulation. On the knotty issue of bow ties and neckwear, from Roderick Remich, Coppenole, Staffordshire, UK. What is the world coming to? Eric Coe notes that gastroenterologists, obstetricians and gynecologists are tending to wear bow ties rather than knotted ties. A bow tie is knotted. A clerk from my former law firm took to bow ties after he leaned over the first shredding machine to see how it worked. And those standing by laughing too much to find the off switch. Apologies to Crow for an inexact classification. We did assume clip-on bow ties, thinking the knotted ones would be graspable by stressed patients. Okay, that's the main thing. By its bouncing, you shall know the battery state. That's right. That's an empty battery won't not bounce as much. It's really interesting that the batteries give up hydrogen as they produce. Gabriel Keller says a charged alkaline battery may weigh a tiny bit more than an uncharged one. Well, that's a bit unnerving. Why would it be? Because it's losing hydrogen. I don't understand. By hearing acid batteries work by reaction with air and moisture and gain mass as they discharge. I measured the discharge battery as weighing 93 milligrams more than the new one. When dropped on hard surface, the new battery lands with a clunk and discharges once one will bounce. I have no idea why, but it's useful when you get confused as to which one is when charging them. Now, I think this is... Yeah, I'm pretty sure... No, that's a new novel thing, that the moisture comes in from the air. That's an amazing thing. So this is whether you drop batteries, they're charged or discharged. Dave Neal suggested, so opinions vary on whether we know it all. From Carl Zetti, Raleigh, North Carolina, USA. Dave Neal suggests that we read New Scientist because we don't think we know everything. Some of us only read the magazine looking for opportunities to send in corrections for this publication. That is actually quite an amazing thing. Okay, there's a... Make, do try this at home. Why wait for a bolt from the blue when you can code your own muse? Oh, this is standard information. That is absolutely brilliant. that's actually quite a funny thing. Okay, wait for a bolt from the blue when you can code your own muse. I'm an aspiring inventor, says Make It. It's like Make It. Okay. But my best work so far is a Fitbit attachment for my dog, so I can game the step counter. Someone beat me to the grape peeler, but where can I get some more inspiration? Creative geniuses all have their own tricks. Yoro Nereshu, who Nak A Matusu, who has 3,000 inventions to his name, takes a deep breath and drives underwater. 0.5 seconds before death, I visualize the invention, he says. But you needn't go to such extremes. My inspiration generator will bring ideas for all. To create it, I first grab a list of random words. When I then use Stanford University's tool for tagging parts of speech, like nouns, adjectives, and some Excel wizardry to arrange the data. With a few lines of JavaScript, a popular red coding language, I can mix the tag words to suitable grammatical patterns. My random art generator was ready for action. Disinheriting underpass, it suggested cryptically. Auto-sexing pie, lasagna categorizing ink. Some prompts were more plausible. I would certainly buy a gratitude showing armchair. Some say inspiration comes from remixing, so I replaced the word list with text from an old make columns. I also added function to suggest a company name combining letters from the words. The results predict your home with Waru, the wandering romba, and revival to the US Uber Eats called Urfu, the USB roving foo. My style indeed. Others say inspiration lurks where you least expected. So I built a version from articles of Gwyneth Paltrow's offbeat lifestyle site, Goop. It was no less rich. Who wouldn't eat UFU, Uberman's refueling spread, especially in a bind, beet cheese basil indulging bran. How do you know if your idea is unique? My program also accesses the number of hits the word combination gets on Google and the availability of the .com domain of each suggestion. The text turns green if you're good to go. I also added an option to email my ideas to select friends. Maybe not a great idea after almost sending swinging services to my boyfriend with no context. Which gave me a great idea for an email retriever. Okay, well, I can tell you that automatic emailing is no mean feat. So we're 32 minutes in and we're into last words, so this should finish this off. Last year we had Christmas pudding that had 2 years old, but it was superb, whereas the one-year-old pudding wasn't nearly as tasty. I read that the supermarket won an award for its 2 year matured puddings. So, what happened over the 2 years to bring out the flavour? Christmas puddings matured as it ages because of the Maillard's reaction. It extracts between sugars and amino acids. It generates rich, complex caramelised flavours and colours. Well, there you go. That's something I really want to know. The Maillard's reaction. Yeah, of course, I read it, I enjoy it, but I'll forget it. The reaction occurs slowly at room temperature, but heat speeds it up. Classic instances are browning onions and roasting meat. Oh, okay, this is interesting. So this is... So should you not freeze? Okay. Often the reaction produces volatile flavours, but long-stored milk powder or fruit juices, for example, these cooked flavours imply a loss of quality. Potato, well, it's Maillard reaction. I have to work that around. Potato tip. I work in a restaurant where the chef saves time by parboiling potatoes and leaving them in water overnight, then roasting them the following day. To stop potatoes discolouring overnight, he puts a slice of brown bread in the water. This old rice table doesn't really work. And does the bread have to be brown? Okay, it's really, really interesting. And think about, and there's this entire thing about the amount of gluten in potatoes. If you let it cool down and then reheat them, they've got a different calorific value. When you slice a potato, an enzyme called polyphenol oxidase is released that catalyzes the chemical reaction between polyphenols and the potato and oxygen in the air. This produces brown contents in the potato called melanins, but can be prevented in several ways. The oxidation of polyphenols can be slowed by keeping oxygen away from potatoes by storing them under water. The water's pH can also be made acidic by adding lemon juice and vinegar. As enzymes are pH sensitive, the polyphenol oxidase loses its catalytic ability, further preventing browning. The addition of antioxidants to water scavengers dissolves the oxygen, stopping discoloration. Bread has an antioxidant capacity. That of wholemeal bread is greater than that of white bread, and the fresh bread is better than stale. Although its tales are not to be lightly dismissed, they are often based on years of trial and error. Enzymatic browning is not at all bad. It develops a colour and flavour in cheese, and without it, chocolate would be bad. So that, there's all this fermenting. So fermenting used by enzymes. So that's an interesting theme. My mother used a similar strategy, but without the bread. She would parboil the potatoes, place them in a bowl of water, go to church and roast them on the Sunday lunch on her return. The water is likely to be a key to stopping the browning through the prevention of oxidation. It is possible that the phenol components responsible for the browning may bind the fibre to the brown bread, but we know little about the chemistry of the interaction of phenols and fibre. Separating the potatoes into two bowls of water, one containing brown bread, is an obvious test. I don't know the possibility for you getting the sack if the water-only condition fails. Wisdom of the crows. New Scientist recently ran an article about crows making up after a fight or keeping their distance from another crow they'd beaten. So how do crows tell each other apart? Crows look like are like to you because you can't see the ultraviolet. Well, get snotted. Most birds can, and the plumage of crows, which to us looks mostly black, is elaborately detailed when seen under a violet light. There's also many matte and iridescent colours of corvid feathers. Seen close up, even with human eyes, the plumage is marvellously patterned. Differences in plumage colorization is often used by birds to mate choice and probably also social interaction of flocks. Covids also vary individually in call sound, so they can tell who is, I don't know, it's by itself, who even when their eyes are shut. It is possible the reason we, as adults at least, can't tell crows apart is due to perceptual narrowing. As humans, we don't need to tell crows apart, so lose the ability to do it, instead developing the ability to recognise human faces. Studies of babies have shown that 6 months old, they have the ability to tell monkeys apart, but lose this by 6 months old, as their brain learns the skill, learns that the skill isn't needed. Presumably, a child who grew up around monkeys would retain it. Something similar happens even with our own ethnicity, which is why people can't find it harder to tell different ethnicities apart than they do their own. Other crows are perfectly identifiable to the crow brain, allowing them to engage in the kind of social activity described. This week's questions. We keep the key to our holiday cottage in a 4-digit safe by the door. Because of my poor eyesight, I move only 1-digit rotors when I leave, so it's easier to open next time. Most visitors rotate all the leaving. Is my behaviour riskier? I would say yes. Okay, thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. How you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.